Hi, kitty cats. I am Amethyst Aherick, your hostess for Gender Identity Weekly, a weekly discussion about identity and gender from the contributors and guests of the Purple Paw Publications website, Gender Identity Today. This content is brought to you by subscribers of Gender Identity Today. If you are already a subscriber, thank you so much for your ongoing support, because subscribers not only receive new content directly to their inboxes as soon as it publishes, but are also able to interact with every contributor directly. And that includes me, which, you know, is like a perk, I think. So if you would like to support shows just like this one, as well as other podcasts and other videos and written articles by our contributors, please consider subscribing using the links that you are going to find in the show notes. So today I am absolutely ecstatic to be speaking with my new friend, Sandrine Marois. Hi, Sandrine.
Hi, very excited to be here too.
Thank you. I can't tell you how excited I am to talk to you, because Sandrine, we actually met, I put out just like this generic post on, I guess, Mastodon while I am Blue Sky, asking for podcast guests, and Sandrine responded. And I looked at your website, Sandrine, and I see you are a poet. I'm going to rattle these all off. A poet, a photographer, a painter, a podcast, and an author of over 40 books. I mean,
yeah. Now I'm at 15, also, actually. 15, oh, actually. Sorry.
go. You're going to have to update your website now. So.
No, I did. I updated like a couple of days ago.
There you go. Sandrine is also co-founder of Auroras and Blossoms, which is a cool community. I was looking at this, a cool community dedicated to creating and sharing art that spans across the human spectrum. And, you know, that kind of fits into what I'm doing. I figured an artist this prolific and outreaching is the perfect guest for a discussion that I wanted to have about how art fits into the human experience and how it sort of fosters our understanding of ourselves and other people. So I got to tell you, with a body of work like this voluminous, I mean, you had to have had this childhood that was just, let me just start over. Take us to the beginning. What was it that got you so inspired? How did you develop this much creativity?
I wish I could tell you, honestly. It's just life. I'm someone who has had a connection with myself for many years. And nothing in my childhood said, you're going to be an artist.
Really?
Okay. My parents encouraged reading. So my mom was a math teacher in high school.
Oh, gosh.
And before I was done with kindergarten in France, I knew how to read, to count, and how to write.
Sure.
Basically, that was it, because my mama taught me. And in France, in kindergarten, it's like, I don't know how it is in the U.S., but in Canada, just about a year. But in France, kindergarten is, you start as early as 2.5 years old.
Oh, gosh.
And you
okay.
go there for 2, 3 years, 4 years until you reach first grade. But during those first years, you learn a few basics. And I think now they learn a second language as early as kindergarten. So when I started first grade, I knew how to read, how to count, and how to write. This allowed me to take advantage of the huge library we had in our house. My mom and my dad read a lot and encouraged education. For them, education was a very important thing, because my dad didn't go to school for a long time. And out of my immediate family, my mom and my aunt, so my grandparents on my mother's side, they were the first one to go to university. So we come from very poor stock. My family has been an example of hard work for me. They instilled hard work and the importance of education, of reading, and so on and so forth. But in terms of art, no one believed that there should be an artist anywhere in the family. I don't know if there is an artist in my family. So nothing said in my childhood, you're going to be an artist. I distinctly remember, though, I don't know which grade it was, but Our teacher in that specific grade encouraged us to write poetry, to write short stories, and asked us pretty much every week, who wrote a poem? Who wrote a short story? Who wants to read in front of everyone? And you got something like a gold star, or your name was displayed on the wall, something like this. Sure. And I distinctly remembered writing a poem on a donkey, I think. The theme was a donkey. I don't know exactly what it was. But I remember the teacher saying, oh, this is very good. But that's all I remember from my childhood, really. And when I was a teenager, you know, teen hormones and stuff like that, emotions, did the guys and some of the girls and whoever struck your fancy, whatever, you wanted to write about that person, because I was not the popular kid, so no one was in love with me, and I was an only child. I'm still an only child. And, you know, I wrote, but the stories and the poems were silly and didn't make sense. And so there was nothing that really said Sonlin is going to be an artist and going to start to write in her life. Nothing really. And it wasn't encouraged in my family. My family still to this day doesn't really care about what I do as an artist. Anyway, you shouldn't expect that from family members, or, you know, that's not the way it works. Long story short, there's nothing in my childhood except this encouragement to read. And I remember coffee table books, history, art, and stuff like that. So reading was really the thing that was encouraged, because my parents really wanted me to be educated, to be well-informed, and to be curious. They wanted me to be curious and ask questions, so on and so forth. But that's the extent, really, of the seeds behind, you know, my artistic garden, if I could put it that way.
Sure. It's crazy to me, too, because it just, I mean, as you were telling the story, it struck me that while many people value reading, we don't really value writing. Because, yes. I mean, what you did was make all of your own stories, your own poetry. Mm-hmm. But if you weren't encouraged to do that, because they could have read that. So if you prize reading, why would you not also prize reading stuff that you wrote?
I don't know. I have no answer.
I don't either.
But the thing I can say is my mother wrote beautifully this item. Wow. She wrote beautifully, but because she helped me with my essays and stuff when I was a kid, and she always helped me and always had a look to correct the mistakes and to proofread and everything. And she said, no, you know what? This sentence, this is okay. Grammatically speaking, it's fine. But this is how you can improve the sentence. So she was very anal, I should say, about details.
Sure.
Yeah. But it gave me a good... it really helped me understand the importance of working on details, of perfectionism taken to the right level.
Sure.
If it makes sense.
It does. I want to ask you, let me ask you this question. I think it was Leonard Bernstein who said, he was quoted as saying, what makes a great piece of music is a good idea and too little time. Yes. Or not enough time, I think is how he says it. It's a great idea, not enough time to develop it.
Yeah.
I've ended up coming to that point too, because it's like, well, I could spend hours and hours and hours writing something that's 1,200 words and trying to focus on every single word. And I've gotten to a point where I'm like, no, you know what I need is to get the timer out.
Yeah.
And
absolutely.
When this dings, I'm finished.
I agree.
It's an interesting, but I think things end up better for it. Because at the very beginning, I would spend a whole day writing something, and now I spend more like 3 hours. Mm-hmm. And I think it ends up better, personally. Yeah. But
I think it depends on the way your brain functions, mainly. I would say that not everyone works well under pressure. Others
True.
Better than others. So I think I would say a case per case basis, really.
It's a good point.
Yeah.
So now you've developed Got to count these. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. So a total of 7. I'm holding up 5 fingers. Pretend I held up 7. All right. Thank you. I tend to do that. I'll be making a video or something like 3 points I want to make.
Whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Nobody's watching. Four. It doesn't make it. Right. So for me, this is 7. I'm just going to run with it. Yeah. But you've made up 7. You've developed 7 different styles of poetry, all of it based around a haiku.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, developing a whole new style, like that's really branching out. So starting writing poetry, you go, okay, well, that's something. Developing a new style, that seems like sort of taking it to the next level. Oh, sure, you shrug. Everybody who's super creative goes, so somebody says, hey, you're super creative, and they go, eh, I guess.
I think this desire to create the way I do and to do some kind of pioneering work in my field stems from a desire to challenge myself constantly.
Sure.
And I think not enough people do that on a daily basis. And a challenge doesn't have to be a big thing. It can be a small thing. And a challenge can be something if you struggle, for example, to go out because it's hard for you to socialize with people. Instead of staying home 24/7, try to go out for 5 minutes. That's the kind of challenge I'm talking about right here. So everyone is different in terms of creativity. So for you, maybe, creating forms is, big. For me, it's not, because it's part of that challenge I gave myself from the beginning. And I remember that from being a teenager, even before I was a writer. I remember wanting to challenge myself because I suffered from such debilitating depression in my life that I wanted to make sure that I was always active, so I would use my energy to focus on things that mattered and that helped the kind of chemical imbalance that was going on to rebalance everything, if it makes sense, right?
Yeah.
So to each their own in terms of the kind of challenges they give themselves. But I believe that people would be a lot happier in life if they challenged themselves more often. And with little things. Not
sure.
Things.
There was... It was earlier on, it was before we started recording, you mentioned people feeling uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, is that what you're talking about? Continually trying to feel, I guess, discomfort?
Well, because if you don't feel discomfort in your life, how can you accept everyone? How can you accept yourself? Something bothers you so much that you want to criticize or you want to throw shades at something, why don't you look into it? Don't you study it? No one is telling you to adopt a child. That's not what I'm saying. But, why is something bothering me that much? Why is it? Why don't I ask questions? And I mean, you can make a mistake, but just go to someone, for example, who eludes you or you think you hate and say, okay, you know what? I have a question to ask you. If it's stupid, just let me know. But I just wanted to warn you that my question may be ignorant. My question may be stupid, but I don't know. So I count on you to educate me. And I've never met someone who was disrespectful with me because I stated things that way. If I approach someone who is different from me, and everyone is different from me anyway, if I approach them from a place of, I'm going to ask you my question. If you disagree with it, it's your problem, not mine. But I want to ask you this question. It might be stupid. It might be ignorant. I apologize in advance, but I need to ask it because I want to educate myself. The person will respond with love, with understanding, and with patience, even if that person has had to explain the same thing over and over 50 times before you.
Right. Agreed.
Yeah.
But if you can go If you go into a conversation, let me see, I want to figure out how to back into this. Most people don't want to go into a conversation saying, you know, I might look ignorant here. I mean, you don't, you're in Canada, I believe, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Okay. So right now in the UK and in the US in particular, you know, there's a lot of people going, I'm going to say something totally stupid. And it is the, it is, you know, the truth, capital T, capital T, capital the capital truth. And that I think is one of our big problems is the desire. I don't want to use desire. It's like discomfort in saying, I don't know something, you know, to bring it back around with discomfort. Yeah. But
absolutely.
I mean, I don't know why that's wrong to be able to say, listen, I don't know something. That's rhetorical. I know.
I think people are scared of being wrong. Because then, and it goes back to the discussion about challenge. They don't challenge themselves enough. They don't challenge their knowledge. I don't know the way Socrates used to say it because I wasn't there, obviously. But I think the famous quote is, be of the world. I mean, what is it? Be of the world without being of the world, but seek the world something like this. I can't remember what it is exactly. In 2024, we have no excuse to live in a bubble.
Agreed.
We have no excuse to say, oh, I'm worried I will be wrong. Because if you go to people and tell them, you know, I'll probably be wrong, but I want you to educate me. Like, you have so much to gain, and people won't be as aggressive as they are.
Right.
Because it's all in the way you say things. I mean, I have a strong voice when I speak. You know, people say, okay, I'm down. Are you pissed? Are you annoyed? And I know, no, it's my voice. So people tend to think sometimes that I'm blunt and aggressive. I'm French, so I'll be blunt. It comes with the territory, unfortunately. But my voice is not something I can change. It's the way it is. So people often tell me, are you annoyed? Are you PMSing, men? You know how they are. But I'm like, no, this is my voice. But it doesn't mean that I have this voice that I am not understanding and that sometimes I'm wrong. I'm afraid of being wrong. So part of the discomfort, I think, to me, and of course, I could be wrong, but this is the way I see things. Because we don't challenge ourselves enough, we don't encourage others to challenge us, but in a loving way. So we live in a one-way street, basically. It's me or the highway. So kids are not used to being challenged anymore. We tell them everything you do is correct, you know, even if it's mediocre, it's, oh, yes, fantastic. No, I think if you go to it with love and understanding and compassion, there's nothing wrong with telling people, you know what, I heard you, but I believe that you were wrong for this reason and this reason, and I'm going to explain to you why. And maybe we'll come, and maybe I'm wrong too, but, you know, the more we talk about it, the more there's a chance that we can actually change the status quo. And I believe people are wrong when they think they cannot do anything. If you educate one person, and that person, then that person will educate someone else.
Right. Oh, it's a whole ripple effect. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So I know one of your early, you grew up loving to read, and I know one of your early, I don't know if influence is the best word for her, but Jane Austen, I mean, not like transparent writing. I mean, fairly opaque writing. Is that part of her appeal to you? Is the depth of thought?
Depth of thought and knowing, because I studied, I'm a former English major, so in France I studied English in depth, linguistics, phonetics, did literature, history, and so on and so forth. And you know, we can criticize the education system as much as we want, but by learning to analyze texts, you know, and books, you know, I really got a deep delve into, you know, literature and the minds of the greatest authors in history. what I love about Jane Austen is what is between the line, what is not being said, which is why I write haiku and I wrote a play and I love all this. And to me, good fiction is fiction that lets you read between the lines and imagine what's actually happening. And Jane Austen is, first of all, a fantastic writer. So if you want to learn how to write well, read Jane Austen.
Agreed.
But it's really the ability that woman had to write about truth when she lived on her own or with her family, but never got married, never had kids, and lived in a bubble, basically. This ability to write with that kind of depth is something that fascinates me, just like Emily Dickinson, if you think about it. Same deal. So two very different women, but if you read them both, you'll see the same. There's a common thread between them. It's the ability to write about things that they would have barely have access to because of the way they lived in a kind of bubble. And this ability to write things the way they did, that fascinates me. Emily Dickinson is not a poet that I always understand because the message sometimes is quite obscure. But I'm working on a project right now with someone else, and I got to reread Emily Dickinson, and I read some of her poems on my podcast as well. And I rediscovered a poem from her, and I'm like, oh my goodness, I didn't get the meaning initially, but now I get it. And the punch in the guts that I got, like, this is a good punch I'm talking about, really good punch. Like, when you drink good wine or good, you eat good food, it's like, oh my God, I feel so happy. It's like, it's inside. It's in your mind. There's something happening in your brain, in your soul. You're like, oh, I feel full of it. And you know, I'm like, oh my God, this is so profound coming from a 20 or so year old or 30 year old writer.
Oh, true. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
You know, I want to, this is a dumb question. Maybe it's not.
Nope.
But I'm going to throw it out. Because like, I mean, I actually love Jane Austen too. Actually, quick question. What is your favorite book by Jane Austen?
I honestly can't answer. Right. Don't have any. I find them all so similar, but at the same time, all so different.
Right.
So, because I translated two chapters of Pride and Prejudice for my thesis, when I took my BA in English to French translation, so my subject for my thesis was Pride and Prejudice. Okay. So part of my thesis was to translate two chapters of the book. And when you're a translator and when you work on the linguistic part of a book, as a linguist, you pay attention to such details compared to someone who would just write for the sake of writing, who may not have studied grammar and so on and so forth.
Sure.
So Pride and Prejudice, because I translated it, part of it, I should say, not everything, but those two chapters, that gave me a unique insight into the way she worked with the language.
And
I think what I find fascinating as well is a good writer will pick a word very carefully. Every word on a page is picked carefully. Why would I say conversation instead of discussion, for example? Or what would I use the instead of a? And because English is not my mother tongue, French is my mother tongue, and English is so influenced by French.
Of course.
Sometimes people tell me, oh, you write a little bit like people in the old days, like classic authors. Because I have this mixture as well, and I've read many, many, many of the classics in English and in French, so it has influenced the way I write as well. So every time I read a book, so Jane Austen, any even indie authors to this day, I pay attention to that side of the writing that others may not pay attention to. And when I say this author is fantastic, is because I can tell that the author pays attention to everything they write on the page.
Yes. I do the same, though. I think that's so important. Sometimes I will look at a sentence and go, it is just a beautiful sentence. I mean, it doesn't even have to be an important sentence to the story, but sometimes I'll go, wow. But, you know, I've actually been accused of that, too. Some people have said that I'm kind of dense, or I was going to say writing is dense, but come to think of this matter.
Intense?
No, dense. Actually, no, I've been called dense, that my writing's a bit dense. Yeah. I mean, presumably writing, but they could have just been talking about me. But because I use phrases, like sometimes I'll have like this 40-word long sentence because it makes sense and it's necessary to convey the point that I intend to convey. So where was I going with that? Oh, it was back to Jane Austen.
No, it's good.
Yeah, I love, her style. Because if I were going to pick a favorite, I think I would go with Emma. Because I love the character Emma is so naive. And it's interesting how everybody around her, you can tell that these people are starting to get in on it and go, wait a minute, what's wrong with Emma? Yeah. And she's just going, yeah, what's wrong? And it's, I love that. I love how the character is portrayed. And I don't know if I always kind of loved like sort of naive characters anyway, but it's that portrayal that gets me. And I guess what really gets me, what's her friend's name? Shoot, what's the Irish girl's name?
I'm terrible with names.
Okay, good. I'm glad you didn't just rattle it off. But her friend that she wants to set up with the other guy, doing great at this one. I can't remember any character, but
That's okay.
That girl's supposed to be the naive one, and that's what's such a great, you know, sort of foil for Emma's, you know, learning about herself. Anyway, that was a way big tangent. Sorry to go off on that, but but you also mentioned like Shakespeare is another one. Emily Dickinson's a great one. Oh gosh, I never asked my question. Sorry, here's my question.
There you go.
I know, it wasn't even just what's your favorite book? Because you can do very detailed writing. Because I was thinking of somebody like a Thoreau. That you read that and you just go, he's like, I watched a leaf fall and it fell for 32.8 seconds and it kept on falling. And then I saw it, and then a wind came by and then it moved it about 4 feet over.
Yeah.
And you just go, all right, great, man. Like, leave a little bit more to the imagination. Yeah. That ended up not being a question.
I love this interview. I love this interview. It goes all over the place. I love it. Fantastic. It's so mean.
Gonna have to edit about 3/4 of it out. If you were to compare the two, like how do you see that? Because I mean, that's the way I see sort of a Thoreau versus an Austen.
I'm trying to think about an answer that everyone can understand, because in my brain I have the answer, but it might be hard for me to explain it. And it's not because English is not my mother tongue. It's just because that's the way I roll in general. My brain is not very ruly. It's unruly at times. I make a huge difference between the classics and modern literature, contemporary literature.
Sure.
For me, the classics, whatever goes into the classic folder is people who have obviously mastered their craft. And whether we like them or not is irrelevant to the question. There's something about the way they write about their stories that withstands the test of time. I know I created, with my friend David Ellis, we created the Hemingcoup, based on Hemingway's six-word stories, blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
but I cannot stand Hemingway. I cannot stand him. His style, and I was discussing this with a friend the other day over the phone. We were talking about how the French translations of his books read better. The translators do a better job of, you know, translating his work, and in French it flows so much better than it would in English. So Hemingway can be thankful to the translators in French. Really, that's what it is. I cannot stand Hemingway. His style, you know, it's terrible. But who am I to judge? There is something in the stories that appeals to so many people that it became a classic.
Sure.
So I have no issue with Hemingway or whoever. I hate 50 Shades of Grey. I think it's terrible. But you know what? It has appealed to so many people. And just for that, unfortunately, one day we'll be in the classic folder. Unfortunately. But that's just my opinion. It doesn't matter what I think. But to me, the difference between good and bad writing, and once again, this is just my personal opinion. I don't want it to stand as absolute truth, because that's
no, what it is. Take a stand. I want to know. Okay. I want to know the Sandrine opinion. Do it.
No.
Please.
For me, the major issue we have these days with contemporary literature is that many authors do not read the classics to understand what makes a good story. Because they do not show enough. And you were talking about Thoreau. That's the point I'm trying to make. You tell us too much. You don't show us enough.
Yes, and right.
When authors come to me, beginners tell me, oh, how can I write impactful stories? I always say, it doesn't matter how good you are at description. It doesn't matter how talented you are. If you do not know how to write a haiku or a play, your stories will fall flat.
Wow.
Why am I saying this? Because the essence of a good haiku, the essence of a good play, is what you left between the lines for the reader to figure out. Instead of telling us, oh, you know, that person killed herself on the train, blah, blah, blah. The way you set up everything is that you leave clues here and there so that throughout the story, the reader can determine, oh, now I figured out that person died on the train at such and such time. Maybe that's the reason why this and this is happening. So you can build your climax and have your twist and so on and so forth. And I'm saying this because I'm terrible at descriptions. I cannot write descriptions. And people would say, oh, it's because English is not your mother tongue. You know, I'm terrible at descriptions, point, period, you know, end of conversation. So I found, and in a way, it's not an issue. It's really not an issue. You know, there are other ways you can counteract that lack of ability in writing description to write something else in a different way. So no matter what you end up doing, whether you want to focus on descriptions or not, it doesn't matter. But if you don't know how to write a good haiku or you don't know how to write a good play, you will have issues understanding how to write a good story.
I see.
So that's the difference I make between the old days when, you know, Jane Austen, the long descriptions. I mean, we in French, we have tons of authors who are famous. Balzac, for example, Hugo. Long descriptions. You would fall asleep. You could skip 20 pages and still follow the story. Nothing would have happened. It was just, you know, there are others. But they have a way of writing that is so beautiful that you're like, okay, I'm going to skip the pages, but I'm going to go back to those pages when I feel like it, because it's still beautiful and I still want to read it. And that's the reason why they're classics. That's the only reason. But the problem I have these days is that not enough authors, you know, know the rules before they try to break them.
I see.
And I don't know if I answered your question, actually.
It was good enough. Now it's telling me I got to go write more haiku. That's the main thing that I'm pulling from it. Do you know, The Man Who Laughs, Victor Hugo, that's one of my favorite books of kind of all time. I don't know. It's the story. Mm-hmm. I know there's like one chapter in it. I think it's in that one where he talks about like a convent. There's a whole chapter about this convent and you kind of go, where the hell is he going with this? You know, and I know like Les Miserables has a story, forgive my pronunciation, has like a story about, oh no, I'm sorry. It was Hunchback has like a chapter about French architecture and you go, where the hell is he going with this? Yeah. And the thing is, it was like nowhere. Yeah. I'm not going to go anywhere with it. I'm just going to write you a big descriptive chapter and you're going to go, yeah, thanks. And like you said, you could skip 60 pages, a good 60 pages, absolutely, and come back in and go, yeah, I missed nothing. But then you can go back and look at just the beauty of like the lyrical essence of the descriptions, the structure of the sentences. Absolutely. And I know he wrote in French and I've only read translations, but you mentioned Victor Hugo. do you not like him or
no?
Did you not like him?
It has nothing to do with that, but it's just the long descriptions. It's just the long descriptions. But Hugo, like his books are classics because obviously the stories appeal to readers. Yes. Have appealed to readers for so, and it's Paris too. So I mean, really, everyone fantasizes over Paris, like
of course,
yeah. So, but I have no problem with that. Whether I like something or not, you know, my opinion doesn't matter. It just the way I like my stories. And but I think authors, honestly, should stop skipping steps. They should say, okay, I'm going to read classics. And the authors who tell me, oh, I don't read, I'm like, okay, oh. So I tell them, so you would go see a doctor. You would need surgery. And the doctor would tell you, okay, you know what? I've never opened a health book. I don't know anything. I'm just going to operate on you. This is an extreme example, but it hammers the point. Because they're like, oh, I see what you're saying. Yes, I said, yeah, you specialize in words. You specialize. So you need a little bit of knowledge right here. You can't just say, oh, I'm going to slap words here and there and write a story. Everyone is going to say, oh, yeah, this is fantastic. This is unfortunately not the way it works.
Right. I think this is a great point that I want to follow up, because you just finished your big multimedia project. That's The Homes We Seek.
Yes.
And this is a combination of photography and poetry.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, like, how do you, with photography in particular, uh-huh, how do you read between those lines? I mean, how do you, let me stop.
No, it's a great question. Mark and... No, it's a fantastic question because no one has ever asked me this before.
Oh, good.
No, this is great. You read, for me, of course I take photos of landscapes and architecture, but I like to focus on the little things that people forget to look at. And that's where the stories come in. That's where, because when you look, you know, what's the point of taking a photo of a leaf and the shadow, you know, on the ground? But then people look at the photo and like, oh, I'd never looked at things that way. Now I'm interested in people. You see people looking. So when I take my photos, of course, in public, why would I? Would I not? So I'm a nature photographer. So obviously people, you know, walk in the middle of what I'm doing. And people sometimes stop. And look at, like, what are you doing? What photos are you taking? So I show them, and they're like, oh, wow, I never paid attention to this. And you see them after, when they leave me, they're like looking down, up, and stuff. And they start being interested in things like that. So that's basically what the reading between the lines happens for me for photography.
I get that. You mentioned a shadow. What about what other things? I mean, because shadows, when you look at shadows of like leaves, mm-hmm, you know, so sun shining through some leaves, especially during an eclipse, by the way, that is so, so fascinating. But I think that is such a study in light and motion and I was hoping for a third word, but I didn't come up with one, so okay. I'll move on. But so shadows, I get. What other things would you focus on?
Moments, for example, one of the greatest photos I've ever taken was when I was in Syria. I went to Syria in 2009, so it was before the civil war started. So I'm extremely lucky because this is probably one of the best, the most beautiful countries I've ever visited. Okay. You remember the arch that was destroyed in Palmyra, right, by ISIS. Mm-hmm. And so we were in the old part of the city. And I had my old point-and-shoot camera at the time. I didn't know what I was doing. I wasn't a photographer then. But, you know, I was taking photos just for the sake of it. And we were walking. And all of a sudden, we hear people calling our names because many people are poor over there, so they're trying to sell you trinkets and stuff. You know, calling you, blah, blah, blah. And we're walking. I still remember, I'm closing my eyes so I can describe it better. So we're walking, the group and I are walking, and we hear those people behind us. And I turn around and I saw these people trying to reach us, running towards us and walking. There were a kid, there were an adult on what you call a dromedary. You know what I'm talking about? Oh, camel.
Oh my gosh, okay.
Camel. So this guy was on a camel. They were trying to catch up with us, basically. And so I'm like, oh my freaking God, I have to take this photo. So I just shot the photo. It was so candid. And to this day, this is my best photo. People see this photo, they're like, oh, I've seen this photo. And magazines, I've tried to buy the rights for this photo because it has the arch. So it's, historically speaking, it's very relevant. And it's such a candid photo. No one posed for the photo and so on and so forth. So to make my point, this is the kind of photos I'm looking for. The things that most of us don't think about. And here I am with my camera and people look at me like, well, you're taking photos of the sun behind the leaves and the shadow, blah, blah, blah. And they look at it, yes. Oh, wow. And adding words to the photos helps cement the stories as well. Because I tend to use haiku for those photos as well. So I tend to try and redirect the eyes, basically, not just with my camera, but with my words as well. So people can finally realize, oh, yes, I don't need to travel to the end of the world to take a photo. I can go to my backyard and actually photograph grass. And I spent 2 years in a row in the summer and spraying with a little bit of water so that he had drops, taking shots of grass in my backyard, like lying down on my stomach and taking photos with the dogs trying to lick me and try. But you know what? That's what I love about photography, about art in general. It's like, people will criticize you, will always say, oh, you could have taken the photo differently. You could have painted differently, light and shadow. You don't know composition. You don't know this. You don't know that. But at the end of the day, if when you take your shot or you paint your image or whatever you do, if you have this hit in your gut that says you have something, then you have great art. That's your reaction. The joy you feel, or it could be the sadness you feel, it doesn't matter. Like if you feel strong emotion that lifts you up, or unfortunately take you down sometimes because that's the way it happens, it doesn't matter. But if you feel something very different in your brain, happening in your heart, you know, your heart beats faster, you feel your soul is connected, you feel like different emotions from what you usually experience, then this is great art. Because you know your audience will feel something. They will not necessarily say, oh, I understand the message. I can actually pinpoint exactly what the person is trying to say. But they will feel something too. Definitely experience something. And that's the journey as an artist I want to take people on. And sure. And now this book is out of print. But I had a book for several years, short poetry for those who fear death. So it was basically short poems, basically teaching you in my own way how to grieve better. Because death sure. is such a difficult topic, and when my mom passed away, she committed suicide after many attempts, and the second last attempt, I'm like, I have to prepare myself, I have to be prepared mentally, not that you can always prepare yourself, but if you start grieving when you know someone is going to leave, no matter what happens, no matter how hard you try, the person is going to leave the plane. You know, they're gone. So I've found that preparing myself mentally, psychologically for that upcoming loss helps you grieve a lot healthier. Faster, not so sure, but healthier. Meaning that there will be a hole in your heart your whole life. But the way you deal with a hole is a lot healthier. Makes you feel your life goes on a lot faster. So when my mom finally died after so many attempts, I'm like, oh yeah, this, so I was right to prepare myself because the grieving process was so healthy, which is why I'm able to talk about it the way I am right now.
Sure.
But I'm like, I know people suffer from it. It's important to talk about it. So I wrote that book. And I didn't care how many people would read it. I don't know. So I think the book, honestly, sold 5 copies. Let's be honest with that. But out of these 5 copies, one person emailed me and basically said, before reading your book, I wanted to die. I've read your book, oh. and I want to live.
Wow.
That's what I'm talking about. This is art right here.
That is art. So... this response, this visceral response, this visceral, I don't have a good word. I'm just going to say yes, mm-hmm. you know, sort yep. of a yes to it. Mm-hmm. Is it because of the stories between the lines that we have less of a response when we get told too much? If we get to fill in the lines, is that yes more... more?
That's a very interesting question. Yes. I think that's because you allow people to process the information in their own way. You don't tell them, this is the way you should react. You allow them to react at their own pace and the way they want. Because if they miss a clue, and then, you know, the answer happens later with the twist and so on and so forth, they're like, oh, I didn't get that. And they go back, maybe, to that passage that they missed.
Sure.
But you don't impose yourself on them. You allow them to have the space to process, you know, the emotions and the information that they're given in their own terms, if it makes sense.
It does. And I think, because ultimately the question I wanted to ask, and you've answered it, was what does art end up teaching us about ourselves? Mm-hmm. And that story in between, story between the lines, I said it poorly, sorry. The story between the lines, when we make that up, that's what we learn about ourselves. And I don't mean to say make that up. You know, when we feel it, when we see it, when we synthesize it, there we go. That's the word I want to use.
Yeah.
When we synthesize it, that's really the lesson we get from great art.
Yeah, absolutely. Because our reactions to things are tainted, no, I shouldn't say tainted, but influenced by our surroundings and the way we process our own emotions, the way we were raised. Right. So I think that's what's so important, to leave so much between the lines. Because I think many authors, and at least it's true for me, we write from a place of experience. Whatever you find in my books is based on my personal experience. And if it's not my personal experience per se, it stems from many conversations I've had with people and the message I heard from them. And that's why I write, basically. That's why I do art, because I want to share the lessons I've learned in life. And you can do that with anything. But you have to be willing to open yourself to it, to the experience.
Yes. Yeah. That ends up... Oh, my gosh. I'm having these revelations, like these flashbulbs going up. I don't think we still have flashbulbs, but because this is really the great lesson of life. Mm-hmm. So we live in this, in this, you know, land of information. Land? No, we live in this life of information overload.
Yeah.
And we keep on hearing more and more and more and more and more. But what we don't see is why all this information is coming at us, where the, you know, what's behind it, I guess. I can leave it at that. But that's, that is a fascinating, I mean, I cannot tell you what a great piece of knowledge. There's one last topic that I had no intent of talking about, but at the beginning, before we hit record, because you always do that, right? You know, you hit record and you go, gosh, I wish we'd have recorded that last bit. But now that we've talked for 50 some odd minutes, you and I were talking about, in particular, the integration of the LGBTQ mm-hmm. community back into the rest, you know, the whole of the world. Mm-hmm. That ultimately, you know, we have just the world, not our community.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the world, there's only one. How do we do that? How is that? And I want to bring it back to the idea of the stories between, because I think the rest of the world, what they miss in our community, and forgive me, I did not say anything about, you are part of this community. And
I totally get it. Yeah.
No. So what I mean, I think that ends up being the story between the lines that the rest of the world sort of misses, that those of us in the LGBTQ yeah. community do see in terms of sexuality or gender mm-hmm. or whatever. How?
It's a very difficult question without being political, unfortunately. But I think... I think we speak too much with our traumas. We let our traumas, you know, lead the way, basically. And we react to people. We treat them the way we used to be treated.
Sure.
I do understand in some situations the trauma is so huge and so deep that we don't know we do it. But in some cases, I believe that some people are so angry that they refuse to be open to, yes, trauma is actually speaking for me right here. It's just the same as imposter syndrome in the writing community or artistic community.
Yeah.
We're so full of it in every sense of the term. And the ego as well. We don't keep our egos in check, I've noticed. And the reason why I was telling you before recorded that I don't feel included in the LGBTQ+ community is because I do not feel that my experience counts as a lesbian.
Counts?
Yeah. I don't feel, because my experience is so different from what you see in the media, whatever the most vocal,
okay,
the most vocal representatives are trying to sell. I shouldn't say sell, but I'm trying to share with the world that people like me end up being left on the sidelines because the trauma I experienced is not enough, if it makes sense. That's what I'm trying to say.
I was going to ask if that's what you were going to say.
I was trying to choose my words carefully.
But that's, I mean, I so understand that. I feel like we could probably talk another 2.5 years just on that topic of
10 years. 10 years.
Ten years.
Perfect. 10.
Well, if you hold up your 5 fingers and I hold up mine, we've got 10. So, right.
Yeah.
I don't know how I'm going to end up putting these two together, but it's a great point, though, because trauma does end up speaking for us. Or, yes, no, that's a good way to say it. The trauma does end up speaking for us. And it's funny because there are people who have said to me, gosh, you have a really traumatic story. And I kind of go, I mean, I guess, but I don't want to, my trauma ends up not being me.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
My story is greater than that.
Absolutely.
And so when I've heard people say that, I go, well, yeah, but look at yourself. I mean, look at what you had to deal with too. I have a friend in particular, if she's listening, she's going to know I'm talking about her, who consistently says, God, I had a great upbringing, good childhood, mm-hmm. Great adulthood, got kids, whatever. I don't really feel like I'm part of the community because I didn't have enough trauma. I didn't hurt enough to get to where I am.
Absolutely.
And that's, I think that's sad. I think that's a bummer. I mean, why would we do that to ourselves?
I don't know.
I guess is what I'd say.
Because, I mean, the representation is getting a lot better in the media and the shows. I mean, I watch a lot of shows and I see, and I remember being glued to my TV when Buffy was on and finally we got our first lesbian couple. And I'm like, thank God, I was in my early 20s. Sure. I'm like, oh my God, I've never seen this before. And then they kill Tara, whatever name she has, like 3 episodes later. And I'm crying. So there's been a lot of improvement for all of us. The representation is much, much better than it used to be. When kids complain these days, I'm like, yeah, well, try living in the 1990s or 1980s. Because I can tell you, where I used to live, there was a tag on the wall in my neighborhood that said something like this: gay people, we know who you are, we'll find you. And that tag was left on the wall for many, many years.
Wow.
I grew up with that tag near my home. So can you imagine growing up, I don't know if it was bisexual, it was lesbian, I didn't know at the time, I knew there was something going on, but seeing this tag every time I went back from school on that wall. So just imagine growing up in that kind of environment in the 1980s or the 1990s. So yes, there's still a lot of work to do. Let's not kid ourselves. But
clearly,
there's so much improvement. And I'm glad to see so many people coming out and, talking about it. But all the stories I see, even in the media, in movies, in shows, it's kind of the same people. Men and women kind of look the same. Men are all like girly and stuff like that when there are very macho men who are gay. And there's nothing wrong. There's nothing wrong with being girly or macho. It doesn't really matter. But all these cliches, we don't realize how much these cliches influence the way we're going to come out, we're going to accept ourselves. And And then people are like, oh, how should I come out? Should I have a party? Should I do this like I saw in this show? I'm like, no. When I came out, it was like I was on the phone 10,000 kilometers away saying, you know why I moved to Canada? Part of the reason I moved to Canada is, it's not everything, but part of the reason is I had met someone and that was it. So I'm like, this is why I moved. And people were like, okay, fine. That's how it came out. It was anticlimactic as you can dream it. And all my friends were like, who cares?
Yeah.
But I was lucky because it could have been worse. People could have said, oh, you know, I'm going to, because I had a few, like, not friends, but acquaintances who didn't really agree. Men and women alike, it doesn't really matter. So I was lucky. But it was still my experience, and I still walk on eggshells even today, because you're not going to say, yeah, I'm gay to everyone, because you still don't know how they're going to react. And all these cliches and all these cliches, and you see in movies and shows, despite the huge improvement in representation, they're still cliches. So you don't know who watches those shows, what people think. And you could still find yourself in a ditch one day because you meet someone who disagrees with your lifestyle. So
right,
that's why you said it much better than me in terms of the trauma, the representation, because because my trauma is not big enough to make the news and my coming out party was not big enough to make the news. So people still think, oh, you still don't know who you are. So I'm like, well, I'm happily married. Right. I've been with the same person for decades. So nothing will change for me, but I don't need a big announcement. But at the same time, I would like to say, yeah, I feel comfortable being part of the LGBTQ plus community, but at the same time, sometimes I'm told that it's not enough, that I need to do more. But it's not the end of the world. I mean, I'm happy and it doesn't. At the end of the day, whatever works for you, I don't need to belong to a community to exist.
Sure.
But I hope I answered the question.
No, absolutely. Oh my gosh, absolutely. No, I mean, because I agree. At the end of the day, like the label, like, okay, I mean, I've got a label. Fantastic.
Yeah.
Does that make me any different? You know, whether I call myself transgender, if I call myself something else? I mean, it doesn't. If I were going to try to sum that up, and it's not like this is a common thing I do, but I'm still loving this idea of the stories between the lines, because I kind of feel like the trauma that's portrayed, those are the lines. And what we need to show between the lines is the life, well, outside the trauma.
Because we what do we want in life, really? What's the big point we want? With transgendered, you know, cisgendered, whatever we are, what do we want is to be happy.
Just to be happy. Right.
My story, your story, is just as valid as anyone else's. Just because it might not be the cliche that we were expecting doesn't make it more valid than other stories.
No.
When we decide we come out for any reason, none of us said, oh, yeah, I didn't think about it. You know, I just decided to, oh, let's improvise the coming out.
Sure.
The big story is that we thought about it for years. It's sometimes for decades. When we come out, it's not like we blurt it out. Okay, I'm gay, I'm transgender, blah, blah. But people are, oh, that's okay. Why didn't you tell me earlier? Because maybe you could have beaten me up, or you could have talked to all your friends. That's why it took me so long to actually talk to you, because deep inside, maybe I went through depression, maybe I went through years of doubts. I didn't know who I was. I didn't accept myself. So if I tell you now, it's because I accept myself.
Yes. So. Yes. Gosh, almost like saying, if you speak from trauma, there is, I mean, and this is not to diminish those stories.
No, absolutely.
Although if you're speaking from trauma, there may be an element of still not completely accepting yourself. And none of us really deserves to live like that, in my opinion.
Absolutely. You know,
each of us certainly should be able to
I agree.
Accept ourselves.
Absolutely.
Well, Sandrine, now, you know, we've been talking for too long. Not too long, but we've been talking, you know, long. Yep. We're out of time. I'll go with that. I was having a hard time. Like, how do I say it to go, okay, I need to shut you down now. But...
It was, honestly, I have to tell you, this was fantastic. I've never this conversation with anyone on a podcast before. So
thank you.
Thank you very much. That's, you know, you have a lot of gratitude from me because this is a dream interview for me, really. Being able, because we talked about art, we talked about writing, but I talk about it all the time, like on podcasts and interviews. So this was an absolute breath of fresh air, really.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I mean, I don't know. Everything I see and read and hear from you, I just go, what a just a beautiful person.
Thank you. But you are too. Like, and I told you I love your hair. So it's part of the magic of, you know, when like beautiful, I'm not going to say beautiful people, but when people who have lived, have experienced things, who have learned, meet, usually you have those conversations.
Right.
Publicly like this on a podcast, that's a different story.
Right, less so, but...
And
oh, gosh. No, I'm going to turn off the recording and then we're going to talk for another hour and a half. That's
no, I'm all good. I'm all good. Go on. No, I'm having a blast, though. So
whatever. Good. Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Well, then I will say thank you to both of thank you to both of our listeners. There's only two of them out there. Sorry, Sandrine.
What a way to end. I love it.
I appreciate you both. Jim and Judy, appreciate you listening. Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you to our listeners, and thank you to Sandrine Marois. I am Amethysta Herrick. This is Gender Identity Weekly. We were talking about art and expressing yourself and the stories that live between the lines. Thank you.
Thank you very much.